to Anamoy Incident Response, the ARRL, CQ Magazine, David BR, K7DB, DXWorld.net, Jerry Spring, VE6TL, Mirage News, QRZ.com, Radio.
This is Kendall Mead of Mascot, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
Tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the air at 90.7 FM on Monday, November 14th. Including at 9 a.m., we'll hear about the forever chemicals in a Rensselaer County town. At 10 a.m., it's time to jump on the Afrosonic taxi. At 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing favorites with Alex Nichols, Boards of Canada, and Tortoise and others at 11 a.m. live from the WGXC Hudson Studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. At noon, after the local news, it's time for the Deep Three show, and then there's new music from around the world on the Vital Weekly program at 2 p.m. WGXC 90.7 FM. Then Kieran Riley is live from Western Massachusetts with the WGXC afternoon show from 4 to 6 p.m. Law and Disorder show comes from New York City at 7 p.m., and stay tuned for radio art and more overnight on 90.7 FM, WGXC. As part of a fundraiser for Temple Israel of Catskill, Rachel Wagman will perform works of Strauss, Mozart, Puccini, Stravinsky, and others on Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at the Temple Israel of Catskill. Find out more about this fundraiser for Temple Israel of Catskill on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of One Universal Media of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice, the world's only 12-hour strong man on the air, here on We Love Radio.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom, wgxc.org, for more information about any of these stories. Mary Dempsey reports for Columbia Green Media that a Columbiaville couple November 4th filed a civil rights complaint in Columbia County Court naming District Attorney Paul Chaika, Hudson Police Chief L. Edward Moore, and other state and local law enforcement officials as defendants, alleging they were subject to unlawful entry and trespass, false arrest and imprisonment, malicious prosecution, and deprivation of a right to a fair trial in 2021. Attorney Leo Glickman of Stoll, Glickman and Bellina in Manhattan filed the case on behalf of Kevron T. Lee and his wife, Shantavia Lee. They are demanding punitive damages and attorney's fees, alleging their Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment rights were violated. Quote, this is not about the money, unquote, Kevron Lee said. Quote, it's more about protecting people's rights. I understand that they, law enforcement, have a job to do, but I want them to do the job in the right way, not cut corners and stop singling people out. This has been a grave injustice to me and my family and caused a lot of hardship. Now, a lot of people are looking at me differently, like I'm a menace to society, and the reality is that I'm a pretty good person. It has also caused a lot of financial hardship for me. Also, my wife was pregnant at the time, and she shouldn't have had to deal with that, especially if they, law enforcement, didn't have the correct information, unquote. Kevron Lee and 10 other people were picked up, and their homes were raided by police in the very early morning hours of August 6, 2021. Quote, the Hudson Police Department arrested and charged Mr. Lee with a violent felony, then trumpeted the arrest to the community, unquote, Glickman said last week. Glickman said the police lacked the required probable cause to arrest and retain his client, but Moore chose to, quote, arrest him and publicize, unquote, the arrest, and Chaika prosecuted Lee despite lacking evidence that he had committed a crime. The suit asserts that the evidence presented to the grand jury following Lee's arrest was fraudulent and in bad faith. In September, County Judge Jonathan D. Nichols dismissed the charges against Kevron Lee, as well as Laurel Roberts and Bruce Pigford, stemming from the same raids. Lee said, quote, I have maintained my innocence throughout. If I agreed to plead guilty, I would have been an innocent man serving time in prison. I was willing to take this case all the way because I knew I was innocent. They, law enforcement, trump up charges on people with no evidence, and there are a lot of innocent people who do not have the financial resources to fight, so they take the plea deal even though they're innocent, unquote. Lee was indicted in a separate case in 2021 on 14 counts following a four-year investigation by the Hudson Police Department into an August 2017 State Street shooting that wounded three people, including two children. That case is currently pending. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. The Daily Freeman reports it was announced last week that starting December 5th, people traveling between the Mid-Hudson Valley and New York City will be able to pick up two new Amtrak departures. The Empire State Passengers Association announced that travelers en route to New York City will be able to choose from a new late-morning train operating Sunday through Friday that departs the Albany Rensselaer Station at 11:10 a.m. The train will stop at Hudson at 11:30 a.m., Rhinecliff at 11:54 a.m., and Poughkeepsie at 12:10 p.m. before arriving in New York City at 1:45 p.m., according to the Amtrak website. And a new daily evening train will leave Albany Rensselaer at 5:30 p.m. to stop at Hudson at 5:53, Rhinecliff at 6:15, and Poughkeepsie at 6:30 p.m. to arrive at New York City at 8:05 p.m. Northbound, a new train from New York City will leave at 8:15 a.m., stopping at Poughkeepsie at 9:45 a.m., Rhinecliff at 10:01 a.m., and Hudson at 10:21 a.m., before terminating at Albany Rensselaer at 10:47 a.m. The second new northbound train will leave New York City from Sunday through Friday at 3:15 p.m. with stops in Poughkeepsie at 4:40, Rhinecliff at 4:55, and Hudson at 5:15 p.m. before terminating at Albany at 5:45. The Passengers Association said this will increase the number of weekday trains from 10 to 12 round trips and reduce sellouts on several northbound trains that extend beyond Albany or Rensselaer. The New York State-funded Adirondack route, which operated before the pandemic between New York City and Montreal, will not be running after December 5th, according to a press release. The association said it expects the route will be returned to service during the first quarter of 2023. Read more about the story in the Daily Freeman. Times Union reports that the Ulster County COVID-19 Commemoration Commission has extended to December 15th its deadline for submitting design proposals for the County Memorial Garden. The garden is envisioned as a space for rest and reflection with interpretive signs linked to a comprehensive website featuring stories of frontline workers and other community members. A spring installation at the Ulster County Fairground complex is planned. The commission, made up of frontline workers ranging from nurses, EMS responders, and teachers to food service, police officers, and other essential workers, was established in March. According to county officials, the project focuses on, quote, frontline workers who put their lives on the line during the pandemic, community members who were lost, and the spirit of unity among neighbors as they banded together, unquote. Information is available at the Ulster County COVID-19 website or by calling 845-340-3800. Read more about the story in the Daily Freeman and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
New York voters approved the state borrowing $4.2 billion for robust climate-friendly projects. The Clean Water, Clean Air, and Green Jobs Environmental Bond Act will provide funds for school districts to get electric school buses and develop the infrastructure to charge them, make state-owned buildings green, and preserve farmland. This is just a sample of the projects this new funding will go towards. Ann Reynolds with the Alliance for Clean Energy New York says this is a culmination of a multi-year effort, but as much as it accomplishes, she notes that what's missing is incentives for electric vehicles.
there's not money specifically in here for incentives to have New Yorkers buy electric cars. And I think that's going to be something that we need. I mean, the plan is to phase out internal combustion engine vehicles over time. But in order to get people to get started on that, they're going to have some incentives to have people buy electric cars.
The Bond Act was met with little opposition in the state legislature and in the voting booth. According to unofficial data from the State Board of Elections, 59% of voters approved it, 28% voted against it, and 12% left the option blank. Although climate change was not a top issue for New Yorkers, this has been a necessity for the state. Reynolds says there has been a need to update water infrastructure in the state, among other improvements as well. She notes that the money isn't just for large statewide projects, but also for community projects.
A lot of the money will be helping communities, like municipalities. So there's, for example, $150 million for farmland preservation, and some communities might have farmland preservation plans. They might have a town goal to maintain farmland, but this is the money that's going to help them do it.
Reynolds doesn't see another ballot measure like this one coming about in the near future, but if so, she'd want to see money allocated for upgrading New York's electric grid to make it more climate-friendly. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Brendan J. Lyons and Rebecca F. Ward report in the Times Union that on November 10th, a federal judge in Albany issued a temporary injunction stopping New York's Office of Cannabis Management from issuing retail licenses in 5 regions of the state. The lawsuit, brought by a company whose application to operate a marijuana store failed to qualify because it lacked, and I quote, a significant New York State presence, end quote. U.S. District Senior Judge Gary L. Sharp blocked issuing cannabis licenses in the Finger Lakes, Central New York, Western New York, Mid-Hudson, and Brooklyn. Officials have been expected to begin retail cannabis sales in New York before the year ends. The ruling comes because Verisite New York One, Incorporated, whose owner has a past marijuana conviction from Michigan, though his company is incorporated in New York, was determined to not have, and I quote, a significant New York State presence, end quote. The lawsuit is based on the Doormat Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution that, and I quote, prevents states from adopting protectionist measures and thus preserves a national market for goods and services, end quote. Judge wrote in his decision that, and I quote, the balance here tips in favor of Verisite, given that OCM has not begun issuing licenses and will not begin issuing licenses until, at the earliest, November 21st. Additionally, all of the defendant's arguments are undercut to some degree by the fact that Verisite only seeks to enjoin the application process in 5 of the 14 geographical regions, and defendants could proceed with the licensing process in the other 8 regions, end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Kate Lisa reports for New York State of Politics that the Conservative and Working Families parties both saw double-digit increases in support in this fall's elections, receiving more than enough votes to secure their ballot lines in New York through 2024. The Working Families Party got around 250,000 votes with outstanding absentee ballots still to be counted, compared to fewer than 115,000 4 years ago. Sharon Cromwell, deputy state director of the Working Families Party, said, and I quote, we smashed our ballot line goal, end quote. The Conservative Party received more than 305,000 votes this election, a more than 20% increase since the last midterm elections. State Conservative Party Chair Gerald Kasser said on November 10th, and I quote, this right now, this is our highest vote since 1998, end quote. Leaders from both parties continue to complain about how tough Democrats and Republicans have made it for any other party to survive in New York. Cromwell said, and I quote, we should be constantly looking at our election laws and make sure that we are crafting them in a way that bring more people in, give more people choice, right? And not ways to make it harder for people to vote or limit people's options, end quote. Read the full story at New York State of Politics. Andre Ameco reports for Porcupine Soup that a wildfire burned 13 acres of woods and brush in Cairo on November 10th. The Cairo Hose Company responded along with other firefighters from Round Top, East Durham, Oak Hill, Durham, Greenville, Kistatone, Leeds, and Freehold to the blaze near 371 Roosevelt Avenue. One fire was treated on the scene for heat exhaustion, but no one else was hurt and no structures caught fire. You can read the full story at Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. As the last votes are counted in the 2022 midterm elections, early returns show some striking results across rural America. Voters defended abortion rights in all five states where it was on the ballot. And in one of the highest-profile U.S. Senate races, Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman prevailed in Pennsylvania by competing in every community.
I never expected that we were going to turn these red counties blue, but we did what we needed to do.
Overall, Democrats exceeded expectations in many rural areas, which defied predictions of a strong red wave for Republicans. President of the Center for Rural Strategies, Dee Davis, says in most elections, jobs and the economy dominate.
There was some surprise that cultural issues like how do we hang on to our democracy, women's access to abortion, were big drivers, and they changed turnout.
In other election news, South Dakota became the 39th state to expand Medicaid. Those who supported the ballot initiative said it goes beyond standard care and will help in such areas as mental health. Western states often have the highest rates of suicide, according to the CDC. Because suicide is often an impulsive act, Michael Siegel with the Tufts University School of Medicine says the high rates of suicide in rural America can be explained in part by easy access and widespread gun ownership.
So people who are maybe feeling suicidal, if they can just run to the store and get a gun that day, they can use it. But if there's a waiting period, they may have come out of their crisis.
Though urban areas have higher rates of gun homicide, suicide by gun was 28% higher in rural areas in 2020. Repeated surveys show broad public support for mandatory waiting periods and red flag laws that allow law enforcement to intervene when there's reason to believe a threat exists.
It transcends urban versus rural. It transcends red state versus blue state, even political party.
If you live in rural America, it's not news that your transportation infrastructure needs work. 12% of rural roads are deemed to be in poor condition, and 1 in 10 rural bridges lack structural integrity. Rocky Moretti with the National Transportation Research Nonprofit has looked at the cause and effect.
A lot of these roads starting to carry a lot more traffic, in many cases large commercial traffic, and so they just weren't built to those standards.
The bipartisan infrastructure law will provide almost $500 million toward improvements. Moretti says roads in sparsely populated areas are key economic drivers for the country as a whole.
Certainly from a transportation perspective, without that boost in funding, it would have been catastrophic.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Alaa Abdel Fattah and Egypt's climate of repression at COP27. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. United Nations delegates have gathered for 2 weeks in the exclusive Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, seeking consensus on tackling catastrophic climate change. Unfortunately, this crucial summit, known as COP27 for the 27th Conference of Parties to the United Nations Climate Change Convention, is being hosted by Egypt, one of the world's most repressive governments. Its autocratic ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, was a general when the Egyptian army refused to suppress the January 2011 Arab Spring mass uprising centered in Cairo's Tahrir Square. after the Egyptian people overthrew the long-standing U.S.-backed dictator Hosni Mubarak. They held elections and formed a popular government. That didn't last long. A 2013 military coup followed by a sham election put al-Sisi in power. He enjoys full support from the U.S. government despite being more repressive than Mubarak. An example of al-Sisi's brutality is the imprisonment of 40-year-old writer and organizer Alaa Abd El Fattah. Alaa, who holds joint Egyptian-British citizenship, has been imprisoned for most of the last 10 years, targeted for eloquently advocating for democracy and liberation. Alaa was key during the Arab Spring, inspiring people with his words and creating free speech tools on the internet. In the violent Egyptian police state with pervasive surveillance and omnipresent secret police, though, advocating for freedom is a crime. Desperate after a decade of arbitrary and abusive detention, Alaa Abd El Fattah began a hunger strike over 220 days ago. On November 6, as COP27 opened and world leaders descended on Sharm el-Sheikh, Alaa escalated his fast, refusing water as well. Without immediate international intervention, Alaa will likely die before the final gavel drops on COP27. Alaa's mother, Leila Swaif, has been waiting every day outside the prison where her son is locked up, demanding proof he's still alive. A mathematics professor, she's a renowned human rights activist herself. On Thursday, she was told her son had received an unexplained medical intervention. Human Rights Watch has warned Egypt against, quote, imposing cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and that hunger striking is a political act, unquote. Alaa's lawyer was informed that he could visit Alaa, but upon arriving at the prison gate, was denied entry. Alaa's two sisters, Mona and Sana, staged a sit-in at the British Foreign Office in London, calling on the government of newly installed Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to intervene on Alaa's behalf and to bring him to the UK. Sunak, who is attending COP27, wrote to the family, quote, I will continue to stress to President Sisi the importance that we attach to the swift resolution of Alaa's case and an end to his unacceptable treatment, unquote. Sana, 28, is now at COP27 and has helped bring human rights front and center onto the climate justice agenda. Sana, who has spent 3 years in prison herself, has been threatened with arrest. President Biden has enormous leverage over the Egyptian government and is attending COP27. 56 U.S. Congress members have urged him to demand Alaa's release. While campaigning in 2020, Biden actually tweeted in support of other imprisoned Egyptian dissidents, writing, arresting, torturing, and exiling activists or threatening their families is unacceptable. No more blank checks for Trump's favorite dictator, Biden said. Instead of fist-bumping the U.S.-backed dictator al-Sisi the way he did with the autocratic head of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, Biden should demand the immediate release of Alaa and all other political prisoners. Leila Swaif wrote to Biden and other world leaders attending COP27, if Alaa dies, you too will have blood on your hands, unquote. Ultimately, the climate catastrophe is not going to be solved by nations, especially by those run by dictators. It'll be solved by a vibrant and engaged global citizenry, inspired to urgent action. In 2019, Matamasser, one of Egypt's last remaining independent news organizations, published a piece by Alaa addressing the climate. It also appears in Alaa's new book, You Have Not Yet Been Defeated. He writes, the crisis, for certain, is not a crisis of awareness, but of surrendering to the inevitability of inequality. If the only thing that unites us is the threat, then every person or group will move to defend their interests. But if we meet around a hope in a better future, a future where we put an end to all forms of inequality, this global awareness will be transformed into positive energy. Hope here is a necessary action. Our rosy dreams will probably not come to pass. But if we leave ourselves to our nightmares, we'll be killed by fear before the floods arrive, Alaa writes. Alaa Abd El Fattah should be attending COP27, addressing world leaders, not on the edge of death in an Egyptian prison. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC renewable weather forecast for Sunday, November 13th. We start each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. $3.98 a gallon is the lowest price on the Gas Buddy website. That's at the Citco in South Caro currently. Then we look at the air quality forecast, which is a 29 in the good range, about the same as on Saturday. The UV index is worse. It's down to a 1. That's in the low range. The National Weather Service in Albany says there's a 40% chance of showers on Sunday, mainly before noon. Then there should be cloudy skies with a high of just 44 degrees and a northwest wind 7 to 9 miles per hour with gusts as high as 23 miles per hour spinning local windmills. There's a 20% chance of precipitation on Sunday night, and low around 29 is forecast. Again, lots of wind, 7 to 9 miles per hour from the northwest with gusts as high as 23 miles per hour. Monday should be mostly sunny, good for the solar panels, with a high of 40, and a continued windy day with 6 to 9 miles per hour forecast with gusts as high as 23 miles per hour. Monday night should be partly cloudy with a low around 22, and then Tuesday should be partly sunny with a high near 39 and a low around 29. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
The Canandaigua Treaty was signed on November 11, 1794. It is a treaty between the United States of America and the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Oneida, Mohawk, and Tuscarora. Every year, the signing of this treaty is celebrated. And to tell us more, I'm now joined by Ansley Jemison, Cultural Liaison at the Natural Heritage Trust, Seneca Arts and Cultural Center at the Ganandaigan State Historic Site. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you and pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So what is important to know about the Canandaigua Treaty?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing to understand and recognize, I guess, about any treaties for that matter, is that when treaties are signed, these are signed nation to nation. And something that's significant about that is the fact that, you know, when these treaties were signed, a lot of them were signed nation to nation. So this represents and is actually kind of an exertion of indigenous sovereignty, Native people being sovereign people, Native people being indigenous people to this land and the original people of this land. And, you know, when we were signing these treaties, these were agreements that were made, you know, nation to nation. It wasn't something that was going to be signed where, you know, when you sign a treaty, you don't sign a treaty with the state of New York. You know, the federal government wasn't signing treaties with, you know, their citizens at the time. You know, we were our own sovereign nation. We were a formidable people at the time. You know, George Washington valued, you know, the Haudenosaunee people, the Seneca people, the Iroquois people. And, you know, so we had a nation to nation relationship, you know, early on in 1794. And, you know, this is something that we still exert as our own people, you know, as indigenous people. We still believe that that's who we are. We travel in our own passports. We have our own systems of governance. We have our own language. We have our own culture. And this is something that, you know, has at different times been damaged and had, you know, a lot of different challenges and things like that. However, these things are still maintained within our communities, within our people. And we are still here. I mean, that's another thing for people to recognize and understand. Now, has the federal government held up on their end of the bargain? Have they felt, you know, fulfilled all of the, you know, agreements in and around the treaty? Not all the time. You know, I mean, land loss has been a big part of that. Land loss has been a huge piece to any of the treaties. And I think that, you know, it's important for your listeners and people to understand that, you know, they were looking for opportunities, you know, when they came here. They were looking for these opportunities to try to expand westward. And, you know, by signing this treaty, this kind of, you know, at least kind of talked about an agreement as to like how we can do this in a peaceable way. How can we do this as, you know, brothers or as people, as opposed to one doing it to the other, you know? And, you know, as we kind of moved along through things and things challenged or changed along the way, it's really been a very difficult sort of experience. So, you know, the nation nation to nation relationship is certainly something that kind of key in and on focus. And you know, for our end, you know, as far as who we are, as far as Indigenous people and how we have that claim, it's important for us to uphold and make sure that we are still who we are. You know, we have our own culture, we have our own governance, we have our own language. And so those are the things and the key elements that make up who we are as people. And so it's important for us to maintain and keep that.
The Sanctuary for Independent Media, where this radio is based,